This is Rolling Start, a series of podcasts with role models across the UK, with people who have provided inspiration from what they have achieved and the resilience they've shown in both their professional and personal lives. The aim is to share these inspirational stories to a wider audience. Today, I'm joined by Reggie Nelson, an analyst at Legal and General Investment Management, a social media influencer, a speaker, a mentor, and a soon-to-be author. Somebody who needs no introduction given his profile. He was proactive, he took a risk, and he gave many people who look up to him that inspiration that no matter how high or what barriers are put in front of you, you can overcome them. Reggie, welcome to Rolling Start.
Pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.
So I've been looking forward to this discussion for quite a long time. I think everybody knows your story, which we'll come on to a little bit later on. But firstly, you know, what are you doing now? You're at L Gym, you're working in the fiduciary team. But for our listeners who may not be au fait with investment terms, what is fiduciary? What exactly are you doing?
I work at Legal & General. I'm a graduate analyst there working in the fiduciary management team. And fiduciary management is essentially having the investment advisory and money management all under one roof. So the typical structure of a pension fund is you manage the money and the consultancy is done by a consultant. Whereas in the fiduciary management world, you do the advisory and the money management under one roof. So I work in both the advisory team and the money management team.
Thinking about growing up, what was family life for you and what was the environment that you grew up in like?
To answer that question, I'll go from the beginning. So I actually was born in Holland. And then I came here when I was about 4 years old. So born in Holland, came to the UK. And when I came over to the UK, it was my sister, mum, dad, and I. So it was all four of us. But growing up was quite challenging. So both of my parents were unfortunately addicted to alcohol. My dad more so than my mum. And growing up, I kind of had to navigate that. And it was quite hard because from a young age, I got exposed to a lot of sort of tension, a lot of arguments, a lot of words of war that was happening at home and stuff. And for me to get out of that cycle and just not witness that, you know, I spent a lot of time outside. So I was outside playing football, playing out with friends and stuff. And when my friends would go home because they were on curfew, I would just go down to play with the older guys around my estate and in my area. And being around them, I got those the sort of stuff that they were doing, so all the sort of criminal activities and the wrongs that they were doing. So from a young age, I was exposed to quite a lot of negativity. And yeah, I think the hardest thing growing up was definitely sort of navigating alcoholism at home, because even from primary school, when I got home, you know, you see your mum drunk on the floor and a beer can on the table, litter up and stuff. And these are things that I experienced probably too many times growing up. So growing up was quite challenging.
Thinking about the influences that you had then, outside of home now, how do you manage to navigate that?
So influences outside of home, we kind of just drew closer to the older guys in the estate, right? So they got to a point where it was all four of us at home, and unfortunately my dad sort of left us. So it was just me, my sister, and my mum, right? So at a young age, I didn't have that sort of male role model or anyone to look up to. Fortunately, my mum sort of got off the alcohol and she got a lot better, and she, you know, sobered up and hasn't touched alcohol since. And, you know, that really helped me when I was growing up. So my influences came from the people that are around me, my friends, and again, the sort of older guys that were on the estate.
You mentioned that they exposed you to maybe some criminal activity. I think that's what you said. How did you avoid not getting sucked into that?
So football was my segue. That was the thing that kept me away from trouble. Because I was outside all the time, I just used football as a way to unknowingly let out whatever was going on at home or whatever I was feeling inside. So although I would be around those guys and they'll be doing what they were doing, you know, you would get involved in some things like, I don't know, if you're chasing someone or if you're just causing damage to something, whatever, all the sort of minor stuff. But I didn't get involved in the sort of things like the drug selling or anything like that, because I thought, you know what, I want to become a footballer and I want to sort of use football as a way to get out of poverty and get out of the environment that we were in. So consciously, I knew that, you know, if I do what these guys are doing, then I'm kind of jeopardizing my future. So that allow me to just take a step back. So I think football was the one thing that really allowed me to not get too involved in the things that those guys were doing.
Does that mean you were quite a handy footballer then?
I was all right. I played at like youth professional and then youth semi-professional, but I didn't get to like a Premier League club or anything like that. It was more so like the League One, League Two clubs and stuff. So I was all right, but yeah, I was really small when I was growing up. So I think I struggled with that, just the physicality of the game. But technically, I was all right. So yeah, put me set in the mid and, you know, I'll cause a bit of damage.
I used to be reasonable. So I played, it's kind of semi-professional. It was a Manchester Amateur League, but people in the first team were getting paid. I was a youth player in the team. I just found, though, that I used to be bigger than everybody else. And when I got to 18, 19, everyone caught up with me. So I went backwards. So, yeah, I didn't make it either. So it's a similarity we've got there.
Yeah, exactly.
Another similarity that we have is not having a male role model at home, or at least for part of our childhood. What do you think you've learned from that?
In regard to not having a male role model around, I think that just helped me to grow up a lot faster. So there were certain things that, because I had to navigate by myself, I mean, I had my mum and my sister there, but there are certain things just as a young boy or as a young man, you need a male around you in order to help you sort of find out what to do in certain scenarios and certain situations. And because I didn't have that, I kind of had to grow up quite fast. And I think that just birthed a few sort of qualities within myself, and even things like a little bit of an entrepreneurial spirit, right? Because even in school, I would get like £10 a week and I would sell different sort of drinks and snacks and whatever just to raise some money. So I would get £10, flip that to make £40 to buy things like my football boots and my football gear and travel from the football matches and training and stuff. Because there were times when I would have to go from London to Peterborough, for example, and come back. And I would use the money that I was getting from selling drinks and stuff in school in order to fund that. So there were certain things that not having that male role model around me, I think it just birthed some of the qualities that I have today.
So we come to your story, your famous story. And I just go back to thinking about my time in Manchester and what it would have taken for me to show the courage that you showed. So what really brings a boy from East London to venture into the areas of Kensington and Chelsea?
So I knew at 17, so I was playing football at 16, signed a contract, but I knew that I wasn't going to make it to the very top. And I knew that the level that I was good enough to play at probably wasn't going to allow me to generate the wealth that I wanted to generate for myself and my family. So at 17, I kind of made the conscious decision that I was going to sort of hang my boots up. But one of the things that happened that led to that decision was that at 17, I actually lost my dad. So my dad was admitted into hospital, and he unfortunately passed away in a coma because the alcohol damaged his internal organs. So when that happened, I remember coming back from training, and I got in and my mum just said, look, you know, your dad didn't make it. And he went to hospital the night before. That moment for me was like a catalyst, because it was then that I said, you know, I need to do something different to provide for my family. And I know that if I do have kids one day, I wouldn't want them to see what I saw or have to navigate the certain things that I had to navigate. So there were a whole lot of different things that came together for me to think innovatively and do what I did, which was to venture over to Kensington and Chelsea. And another thing that happened was, fortunately, just rewinding the clock a little bit, when I was around 16 and 17, that's when the friends that I was around started to get picked off one by one. So some of them were going to prison. Some of them were, unfortunately, losing their lives to knife and gun crime. And I started to see, you know, the big group of us that, you know, innocent young kids. And fortunately, because I was traveling from London, outside London every day from 16 to 18, I missed the prime trouble that was happening around that time. Mm-hmm. And my friend around that time as well invited me to this church service, which was, again, something that helped me to just stay away from all the negativity that was happening and really helped me to align my faith and to build my faith as well. And I think that's one thing that's really helped me to move on in this journey. So there were different messages that I heard, like come out your comfort zone, which I held on to. And I remember watching a TV show as well by the late Joan Rivers called How Do You Get So Rich, where she goes onto the streets of America asking random people, how did you buy this car or how did you buy this watch or whatever? And the show was for comedic purposes, but I saw a lot of practicality in that. So I decided to use that for myself. And I said, you know, if it's working for Joan Rivers and, you know, albeit this is for comedic purposes, then surely something could happen if I go over there and ask wealthy people how they amassed their wealth, because that's what I wanted. I wanted to find out what skills they had. And that's what led me to go to Kensington and Chelsea. A quick Google search, the richest areas in the UK. I quickly saw that a lot of them were in London. So I narrowed it to richest areas in London. And I went to Kensington and just started asking random people how they became rich.
What were the responses that you were getting from people in general?
Yeah, so I remember coming out of the station at Kensington, Chelsea, and it was a different world. The streets were clean, the cars lined the streets, you saw Aston Martins, Range Rovers, and the rest of it. And the first person I asked just blanked me completely. And I remember stopping him on the street, like, sorry, sir, do you live in this area? And he said, yeah, obviously looking at me in a strange way as if to say, who are you and why are you stopping me? And I asked him the question, you know, how did you manage to live in this area? And he just completely walked past me and blanked me. I don't know if he thought I was trying to sell him something or something, but yeah, that didn't work. So early on, I received a lot of rejections. And I remember like one of the highlights that day before I met the family that I met was I saw a man walk into his Aston Martin, and I jogged up to him and I asked him the question, you know, how did you become rich enough to buy the Aston Martin and stuff? And he gave me some great advice, and afterwards he gave me 40 quid just for asking the question. So quite early on, I was encouraged because I now had 40 quid in my pocket, which gave me a bit more fuel to keep going. But asking people on the street wasn't working. So then I started to go to the different hotels in Kensington and Chelsea, asking the receptionists, you know, what type of people stay in these hotels. And again, I didn't really get the tangible responses that I was looking for. So I decided to up it and knock on people's doors. And the reason, the thought behind knocking on the doors was because no one was even stopping to talk to me. And that's all I wanted. I wanted someone to at least talk to me and tell me what skills they had so that I could extrapolate that and use it for myself. I thought, if I knock on doors and people have to open a door to tell me to go away, or they have to open a door to give me the advice I'm looking for. So I started that technique, and knocking on various different doors led me to the one door that ultimately changed my life forever, which was knocking on the door of Quinton Price.
So I did door-to-door sales at one point. I remember I was selling energy, and I do remember, I think I lasted like 2 days, because you know, the amount of people that were just closing the door in my face, that must have happened to you, right? And that must have been really quite demoralizing.
It happened early on. It happened throughout the whole day, actually. But I knew why I was there. That's the one thing that was in the back of my head. And I had made the trip to Kensington, traveled almost an hour, just under an hour to get there. It was raining as well. So I was like, you know what? I'm already here. It's raining. Nothing can get worse. It's getting cold. I might as well just give all that I have now so that I don't come back. I didn't want to leave there thinking, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. I just wanted to leave everything I had in that area so that if it didn't work, then I can say, you know what, I had an idea, it didn't work, I need to find the next idea. And I knew that if I did give my all in those hours that I was there, then something would come of it, and it did.
So as you said, you knocked on Quinton's door. Who at the time, was he head of fundamental equities at BlackRock?
Yeah, he was head of Global Alpha Strategy. So he worked in the fundamental equity team, but was overseeing everything globally.
So what happened there? Because was he actually in?
No, so I knocked on the door, and his wife initially answered the intercom, and they have a camera in their house so they can see, she could see me, and obviously didn't know who I was. So she asked me what I was doing there, essentially. And I gave her my pitch. I had a pitch that I rehearsed for days and days, and I said it to her. And she initially asked if it was part of a school project. And I remember saying to her, no, I'm here by myself. And when I said that, she opened the door and invited me in. And she sat me down, we started talking, and that's when Quinton walked in. So Quinton was parking the car because they had just come back from a Chelsea football match. And they had just got in like 5 minutes before I knocked on the door. So if I knocked on that door like 5 minutes earlier, I would have missed them completely. So when Quinton walked in, he sat down and then he introduced himself to me, told me what he did. And then he mentioned that he worked for a company called BlackRock. He asked me what I wanted to do. And I was honest with him. I said, look, I'm not sure. I like the idea of business and I'm a bit fascinated by technology. But in all honesty, I don't really know what I'm doing with my life. I don't know what I want to do next. And he explained to me what BlackRock was, what they did. It sounded interesting. And he said I should leave my email with him. And he will see if BlackRock had any sort of insight days that I could have, or just see what he could do to potentially help me out. So I left Kensington and Chelsea. It was on a Saturday. And on the Monday, Quinton actually emailed me and told me that BlackRock were having an insight day for undergraduates. So although I was still in college at the time, I was able to go to the insight day just to see what the whole asset management sector was like. So that was my first encounter with the city and the corporate world.
And how was that insight day?
So I laugh because I just cast my mind back. I mean, my tie was like super short, my shirt was too big for me, I had these like fake pair of glasses where the lenses aren't real, and I thought, you know, smart people wear glasses, right? So I put these fake glasses on and I walked into the BlackRock building and they were super uncomfortable, so I took them off. I was so nervous and I didn't know what was what, right? So it was all new to me and stuff. So I remember getting to BlackRock like an hour early, and I was sitting there waiting for all the other undergraduates to come, and then we had to sign in, and I spent the whole day at BlackRock and I didn't understand a word of what was going on. They were talking about the markets, talking about different asset classes. We played an investment simulation game and I was literally sitting there soaking it all in, not knowing what was going on, but understandably, because, you know, the undergraduates didn't really expect me to input much because I'm a college student, and obviously the campus recruiting team at BlackRock didn't really expect much either. It was literally for me to experience it and learn. And that was the day that I said, you know what, this is something that I could potentially see myself doing long term. And that insight day led to a week long work experience that year. So I did a week long experience at BlackRock, and then that experience led to a meeting with Quinton and a mentor of Michael Nathan, my mum and I, in this room. And that's when Quinton encouraged me to go to university, which was, university was a plague I was running away from, to be completely honest with you. I never wanted to study in university. I never wanted to study past or college stage, but that meeting encouraged me to go to university. So that's when I decided to do it. So I decided to go to university really, really late on. And decided to study economics and Mandarin alongside my degree.
No, that's fantastic. But then you completed university. What was your journey from university then to Elgin?
Yeah, so university, did 3 years. I found my feet academically, found my feet within the whole finance world. I think I completed around 4 or 5 internships throughout university, and navigated university pretty well. So I graduated in 2017. So from the time I graduated, no one actually knows this. I don't think many people know this part of it, but so when I did a summer internship at BlackRock, I unfortunately didn't get the graduate offer for various different reasons. But the main reason was confidence, right? They narrowed it down to confidence. But I didn't get the graduate program. So I went back into my third year not having an offer to go into like a graduate offer at all. So then I'm applying left, right, and center, and I'm not getting into sort of any asset management firms or investment banks and stuff. So I got 2 offers, one at a fintech firm and one at a consultancy. And I managed to, I just took the fintech offer. So after graduating, I went to a fintech firm and I was there for about 6 months. And it was like the Google of finance. There was pool tables, PlayStation, free drinks, free food, all the rest of it. Although the environment was really cool and really young and really, you know, vibrant, it wasn't what I wanted. I knew that asset management was something I really enjoyed and I wanted to get back into. But nothing was working. I was applying left, right, center, using recruiters, trying to do everything I could to get back into asset management, but I couldn't. So what I did was I wrote letters to different people at different firms. And I remember writing, I think it was 41 letters to 10 different people. 41 letters to 10 different institutions. So different people at different firms. And I remember putting like a suite inside of the letters and just kind of pitching myself and selling myself. And I sent it to these institutions. A handful of them came back to me. Elgin was one of them. And I had a coffee with someone from Elgin. And they just said they'll let me know if any opportunity came about. Surprisingly, they actually did. And the coffee meeting some weeks later led to an interview for a temp position. So I did the interview, I got the job, and I came into LGM as a 12-month temp. And after 6 months, I was made permanent. And because I was still relatively fresh from uni, they put me onto the graduate program. So that allowed me to rotate across the client teams and also the investment teams. So that's the sort of journey from university into LGM.
A couple of questions jump out to me, actually. The first one is around confidence. Now, you've done a rotation in my team, the asset allocation team, and yeah. We got you to present after a couple of weeks, right? And you were, after a week, and you were phenomenal standing in front of 30 people. I'm astounded, given everything that you do, that confidence was an issue. I want to kind of touch more on that on what you think happened in that period.
So looking back on it, I think it translated into a lack of confidence, but for me, it was simply, I didn't know how to navigate the whole social side of things. There was a big social disparity between myself and the people that I was working with and the other interns. And from the get-go, from day one, I was the only non-Rust Group student on the internship. That kind of made me feel uncomfortable. There was 9,000 applicants across Europe, and I was one of the only non-Rust Group students there. 9,000 applicants, 115 of us got it. I was the only black male there. And when I'm there and I'm seeing everyone, and there's just so many different questions running through my head from the very first sort of week. And that I'm now having to navigate the work that I've been given, trying to impress the people I'm working with, but also having to indulge into various different conversations that I don't know anything about. People were talking about golf, people were talking about rugby, cricket. I didn't know any of these things. They were talking about the various different varsity teams and universities. I didn't know any of these things. So being in those conversations, because I didn't, the way they were talking or get involved, I think I just took a step back and thought that if I worked hard enough in the projects, then, you know, that will be enough to secure my place. So I kind of withdrew myself from certain people, and I thought my work will be a testament and help to get the offer, but it didn't. And I think just me finding that social disparity hard to navigate, to them probably translated to a lack of confidence. But for me, it was just, I didn't know how to talk to these people, because they're very different to me. They don't talk like me, they don't look like me, they don't sound like me. And I think imposter syndrome was something that just crept in sort of quite early on. I saw myself as someone that maybe didn't belong there, or I saw myself as someone that in my head is like, these people are here for one reason, and I'm probably like the token person, the person that kind of just got the offer for the sake of getting the offer and stuff. But obviously that might not have been the case, but it was just very hard for me to navigate. And I think over the 8 weeks, you only have an 8 week period for you to impress. And I guess within those 8 weeks, I wasn't able to navigate that sort of social disparity and well enough to get the offer.
I think that's amazing, actually. And it's something that I didn't actually know about you, that you, and there's so much similarities to when I first started and you first started. It's absolutely frightening. But how did you bounce back from that? Because clearly that's a real blow. You know, to say you're having a confidence is a real blow to your confidence, right? So
yeah.
How did you bounce back from that?
So when I heard that, I was crushed, right? So as you can imagine, I kind of went to university for BlackRock, essentially. BlackRock was the firm that I always wanted to work for. I did the 3 years. I got tons of experience and stuff. And in the end, you receive a phone call saying, unfortunately, you didn't get the offer. So I was quite sort of crushed. And when I got the feedback, I was like, okay, I see where you're coming from, but in my head, it's like, I see where you're coming from. But to me, it wasn't the case. But I just said, you know what, we move on. And I went into my third year, and I said to myself that wherever I go next, I need to make sure that this imposter syndrome doesn't creep up on me again. And I think the first thing was just talking to Quinton about it, talking to Nathan about it as well. And they helped me to see that, you know, you are bright and you are talented, and, you know, don't ever allow your circumstances to deter you from whatever it is that you want. That was the first thing. So when I got into my first year, my final year, sorry, and I managed to get the fintech job, I performed well then. And when I eventually got into LGM, I made sure that I was sort of relentless in regard to the work that I was doing, how I networked, and just made sure that I learned from my mistakes. And that helped me after 6 months to get the permanent offer. And then from there, it was just becoming more comfortable. And as time goes along, you start to learn certain things. You start to learn how to conversate with certain people, how to build new interests, how to just become more cohesive in regard to your immediate team and your wider team. And once I learned how to navigate these things, it became a lot better for me. So I think it was just a learning curve more than anything else. Once I understood the environment, the sector, confidence just started to brew even more, and I became a lot more comfortable and confident within myself.
That's brilliant, because as I say, you are, for somebody who has been in the industry for a few years, I'd say you're probably one of the most confident people I've ever met, actually.
That's really kind. No, thank you.
And you're humble with it as well, which is really important. So just coming on to family bereavement, I have suffered from my grandmother dying 10 years ago, just before I got married, and that was it really hit me hard. So just thinking about your family and the impact of your dad passing away, I suppose, what was that impact and how did you bounce back from that?
That impact on my family, I always say that the death of my dad was obviously unfortunate, and it was really hard for my family to bear. But that event, for me, it changed the course of my life, because that was when there was a light bulb moment in my head of, I just felt like my mum and my sister were now looking to me and depending on me. And, they were looking for some source of strength, and me being only male in the house, I just felt like they were looking to me. Even though I'm the youngest, I just felt like they were looking toward my direction. So there was a light bulb moment for me, and that's when I said, I need to find a way to provide to help my family and to help my family get out of the sort of situation that we're in. So in terms of impact, it had a negative impact on my family, of course, as you can imagine. Mm. But it was one of the things that really helped me to become more resilient, tenacious, and just installed a different drive within me to help my mum and my sister. And I think one of the things that did that was, I think I alluded to it before, was just the faith element of things. And I think when I found out the news, I just ran out of the house, and I was walking with no direction. I got on a random bus and I was just sitting on the bus, and I was like really, really upset. And I remember just getting off, and I just walked to church and just sat down there for hours and hours and hours. And I think just the whole faith side of things just instilled an unwavering hope within me, and it just really helped me to just gain strength. So throughout that period, that was one thing that helped me as well, just clinging on to that. So there were numerous things that stemmed from it, but I think the impact it had on me and my family was a negative one initially, but it's the reason why I did what I did and how I got to where I am today. So there were some positives, if I can say, to take out of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. Thank you for sharing that. It's very powerful. Just outside of fund management, you're on podcasts, you're writing a book, you're hosting conferences. I think you're a regular now on BBC One Extra, or is it One Extra?
I do some stuff for One Extra and Five Live and stuff, yeah.
So can you tell us a bit more about all of this stuff that you do, and also what drives you to do all of this?
Yeah, sure thing. So when I started working at LGM, I started to do like these little speaking engagements I did one for an organization called Bright Network, where it's like a organization that helps students gain internships and stuff. And I was an alumni for them. So I did this thing called Alumni Success Stories, where anyone that finishes university and lands a job, you go and share your story to students. So I did that, and it just gained a lot of attraction from students, and word of mouth got around. And I did a documentary for the BBC in 2018, and that led to more people finding out about my story. And I did some really high profile interviews and stuff. And then I did a campaign with the former Prime Minister, Theresa May. I went into ITV and stuff like that. So I did this sort of media rounds and stuff, and that got me and my story out there. And then once I did that, just through various different interviews that I did, different organizations started to tap into me and ask if I could do different projects for them. So I started for one project, and then word of mouth got around. I started to do all these various different projects, and the podcasts came about because of the interviews that I did. So I did various different interviews, namely with BBC. And then I got a phone call saying, you know, we're doing this sort of money business podcast thing. Do you want to get involved? And I said, yeah, sure thing. So that's how I kind of got involved in the BBC podcast. And then BBC is a big place. So One Extra started to get involved and asked if I could do certain things for them. So I did it for them. And then just the conferences and stuff. Again, that was just word of mouth. So one organization got in touch and said, you know, can I do a talk for their staff, or can I do a talk for this initiative that they have? And then just, yeah, again, word of mouth. So I did one for a law firm that translated to another for a law firm, and then an investment bank and an asset manager. And then before you know it, I did a talk for Heathrow Airport at one point. So just, different organizations kind of get, they start to know what you do and what you offer. And I started to do more of that. And the reason why I do it, honestly, it's because of the impact it has on people. Initially, I started to do it because I knew what it was like and how hard it was to navigate university and this whole corporate space. And not knowing how to navigate it ultimately cost me an offer for a place that I really wanted to work for. And I knew that there are a lot more people like me from the environment I grew up in that are going to face exactly the same things I faced. So I wanted to almost give them a handbook as to how to successfully maneuver that. And just through the responses from my talks and stuff, I mean, I've had people that have said, I heard you speak, or I was at your talk, whatever, and it gave me courage to apply for this firm, and I got it, and I never knew I was going to get it. I received a message from someone saying, I read your story and it gave me the courage to go and buy a house, right? And it's these things, when you hear it, when you read it, it's like, you've got to keep going. You've got to keep doing it, because ultimately I just feel like people are depending on you. In a way, I'm not saying that, you know, all their burdens are on my shoulders, but if someone can read my story or see what I'm doing, or can hear me on BBC or whatever it might be, and say, you know what, if Reggie can do it, then I can do it, then that's the ultimate goal. So once I realized that, you know, this story has more, it does a lot more than I think it can do, that's when I started to get involved in more mentoring. And then I started to mentor for youth organizations and get involved in a lot more charitable things as well. So yeah, the story in itself just had more legs than I ever imagined, which is why I continue to do it, because I know that it continues to help people.
And just on mentoring, I agree with you. Mentoring is really important. And if you want to navigate the corporate sphere, you know, having that mentorship is, you know, it can really help you to do that. But you have your own mentoring business, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that and what's going on with that?
Yeah, sure. I have a mentoring initiative. It's essentially just helping young people gain the confidence that they need to enter into not just the corporate space, but to do things, if it's entrepreneurial or if it's in sort of the media space, marketing, whatever, just gain that confidence and provide them with the social capital that they need in order to climb the ladders. It's almost like sending the elevator down so that they can get back up. So I go into different youth organizations and mentor people just to help them do that, essentially.
Thanks, Reggie. You mentioned the riches of Kensington and Chelsea. And clearly, money isn't everything, but it does help you climb that social mobility ladder.
Yeah.
What other things are important to you?
So at first, when I set off on this journey, you are right, it was solely for monetary gain. I just wanted to become wealthy. That was the ultimate aim. But now, as I've obviously grown older, matured, and, you know, been through life's journey, money is definitely not the most important thing for me right now. It's definitely creating that impact. And the most important thing for me is being some source of change to help people, to help young people, to help people, particularly from one end of the social spectrum that I've been through, to get onto the other side of the social spectrum, essentially. So my aim is just to create change. And that is predominantly why I do certain things, some of the things that I do. So being involved in some of the things in sort of political sphere, or being involved in broadcasting, whatever it might be, it's just to show people that whatever you've been through, the hardest moments always create the best stories. And if I can do it, then you can do it. That's my ultimate aim, and just to create tangible change for young people. So it did start off as a monetary thing. You know, how can I make money? How can I get out of poverty, essentially? But now it's about change. How can I create tangible change? How can I create long-lasting change? And how can I help people around me to move on that social mobility spectrum?
I like the way you just threw Theresa May's name into your talk before. So before. You know, I spoke to Theresa May and I was like, okay. Reggie, thank you for your time. You are somebody who didn't wait for good things to happen to you. You went out there and made it happen. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
And thank you to all listeners. This is Rolling Start, a series of podcasts with role models across the UK to provide inspiration by showing their resilience in both their professional and personal lives. Thank you.